and welcome to the Tortoise Shack Sunday special. We are back again. This is the ninth in a row, which was something that we said we'd try, which is really, really, really crazy. If you want to come along to these events, it's tortoiseshack.ie. You will read all about it. All our Patreon details is on the Tortoise Shack website, including today's is being held with here with Martin, unfortunately still here, Caroline from Glow West and now the COVID Care podcast, which by the way is really, really excellent. Well done, Caroline. And Linda Hayden of the Pack Woman podcast. Linda, just your podcast came out this morning with the Dead Zoo.
Dead Zoo. So we had Paolo Viscardi very kindly brought me into the Dead Zoo to have a look and see how their renovation project is going. So that was very exciting because I'm a bit of a history nerd, so dead animals and history, big win for me. So there's some brilliant work going on there, and I think the biggest thing about it is that they're doing loads of conservation work to keep it the same as it is. They don't want to change, so I love that because as an inner city dub, it was my big thing. I used to go there a lot as a kid because it was free. So to go back and to see all the work that's happening, and I got to touch the whale skeleton and everything like that. So it was brilliant. So do give it a listen. There's a really good conversation in there about conservation and how the Dead Zoo links in with that. So
Paolo's a great guy as well.
He's amazing.
He's one of the very best. Look, we're just going to go. I want to touch on a couple of things from the week, obviously, that was. But we have the budget on Tuesday, okay? And I want to be very frank on this. We're hearing some incredibly ill-thought-out, ill-judged ideas around the budget. The budget, Martin, I know you said it doesn't is a blip, it doesn't matter this year, but they're an additional $6 billion. We're raiding the rainy day fund, which you know we put aside because we said, and people are going, oh, wow, isn't that great that we put that money aside? At the same time, Spain is taking $140 billion because it's money for free. It's in the form of grants and interest-free loans. And they're going to create 800,000 jobs, rebuild their economy and tackle inequality. That is their plan with the money that's on the table from the EU. Ireland is raiding its own rainy day fund at a cost to us, in effect, rather than actually avail of the free funds. I don't want to hear about Prudent Pascal. I don't want to hear about us rebuilding our reputation. It's a sick mindset that says Ireland wants to be get a gold star for being the best boy in class. That goes back historically, and it needs to be called out. 1920s economics doesn't work in 2020. I don't know if any of you guys have listened, but we spoke to Seamus Coffee a few days ago. It was out for patrons immediately. And he admitted as much. And he was head of the Fiscal Advisory Council. He said, you spend your way out of a recession. You build, you increase capital spending and you protect the most vulnerable. We can do that now. There is no excuse not to do it. I don't want to go on too much about it other than the next 48 hours, you'll hear a lot of bullshit about protecting mental health. You'll hear a lot of bullshit about, you know, we also need to save these businesses that need to be saved. We can do all of that in one thing if we were to do it strategically now, borrow for what we need and build it into a new economy that serves the society as opposed to a society that is a slave to the economy. That's my rant over.
I think, though, Tony, you're forgetting that we have the Greens in there and they're dedicated to a just green transition. And as such, I'd expect the Greens to be pushing the agenda that we should be rebuilding on the basis of a just green transition and creating jobs where we need them most. A little bit of snark in there because they're not doing it and they should be. And they should be the ones forcing Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael down that route.
I'm going to just come in on that and say the Climate Action Bill published this week by the Greens, and I've, you know, again, we're guided by experts like Attract the Evrin and Sinead Mercier, and they're pointing to the fact that it's very light on just transition. In fact, I don't think she could find the terms just transition within it. And it's very light on the carbon reductions and the 2050 targets. At the same time, Fine Gael, who are members of the EPP in the European Parliament this week, abstained on the vote to actually meet the carbon targets. So if I'm Eamon Ryan standing up and I'm launching a climate action bill, meanwhile my the tail that wags the dog is off in Europe saying, well, we're not actually signing up to this. I mean, you know, the message is very loud and very clear that it's a lot of it is climate action in so far as Lorna Bogue said it last week. Unfortunately, it's some of the worst fears that we have of the Green Party. Anyway,
I'm going to come in there on your budget parts there. The fact that you've both said, oh, this is about work and about jobs and everything else. And I had a bit of an eye opener on that on the COVID Care podcast, plug there. But when the first episode looked at the experiences of carers and Michael or Michal, he was talking a lot about there's this 5 million fund for carers. And he's like, oh, that's great. You know, if you look at it on the surface, the reality is most of that is going to organizations. They're not actually going to carers and they're not actually going to people with disabilities themselves. So, you know, he had really great points about how, you know, a lot of these funds and initiatives and everything for the most vulnerable people in our society is all geared up to getting them back to work and getting them into the workforce. And he's saying that's just not an option for some people. So is it the case that they're not actually considered valuable members of our society because they're not ever going to work? You know, whatever is going on for them, that work is just not an option. And we're not exactly a society set up for access and, you know, even like the basics of like wheelchair access to various places. But if you have multiple disabilities, so it's just a really important point, and I think to really drill down that, you know, the budget shouldn't just be about getting people back to work, it should be about improving the lives of people that can't go back to work and will never go to work, and also that's okay, you know, and they should have a comfortable life and not have to live off 204 quid a week. I think they got an extra fiver a week there the other day, and it's like, that's not going to do anything. So, you know, he's really great at tweeting. So he's Momlin, so it's MOMLGN, and it really like loads of tweets about the budget and disabilities and stuff, and I definitely urge everyone to go check it out because it's been an eye-opener for me. I haven't had, you know, that kind of exposure before. So yeah, just a little rant there about like we're not just economic units, we're just people who deserve to not
unproductive live in poverty. Ones Carolyn.
Yeah,
this is where we're seeing the what's happened over the years, where the budget has been taken from disability, from mental health, and channeled back into an overcost hospital. And now we have we don't have the resources to man ICU beds. That's the problem. We don't have the doctors and nurses there to be able that are specially trained to be able to do that. And that's because of consistent budget cuts. So they can talk out of both sides of their mouth, you know, because they say that they're going to do this and then they redirect those budgets halfway through the year back to projects that are running over budget and that are being mismanaged. So where are we going to hold that level of accountability in this budget?
Yeah, the simple fact is that they don't. They just, when it comes to the budgets we've seen, they've consistently reallocated or diverted funds from other things to other things. And, you know, it's not about mental health. It's about certain aspects of people putting the economy before the well-being of our citizens, which leads us on to actually, obviously, we'll have to talk COVID, but I do want to talk. We've Orla Hegarty is joining us on the line now. And Orla, you wrote a really great piece about, well, and you've been championing it for a long time now, but the need for ventilation and how we actually prepare workplaces, make safe environments and safe living standards. Do you want to just give us a quick synopsis of what your argument is?
Yeah, thanks for having me on. I suppose my point is people, I think our public health message is not telling people that the really obvious thing is you get COVID from breathing it in. Wearing a mask obviously hugely cuts down on the likelihood of you breathing it in. When you're outdoors, it's diluted, so you're much, much safer. But indoors is 20 times more risky than being outside. And when we were dealing with this in the summer, people were used to having their houses fairly freely ventilated. The doors and windows were open. They were out meeting outside. They were sitting in the garden in the evenings. But as we've moved into autumn, people just automatically move inside and close their windows and doors. And they may be meeting the same people they were meeting 6 weeks ago. They may be behaving in exactly the same way, but the risks have gone from 1 to 20. You know, 20 times the risk. So when the word has gone out this week that it's behavior change and people are behaving badly and we need roadblocks and fines and lockdowns, there's a huge assumption there that it is people behaving changing their behaviour, and not that they just don't know that doing the same things now in colder weather is much more risky. And they could be having four people into their kitchen for an evening and thinking it's fine, and it might be really high risk because it builds up a bit like smoke in the air. You know, if you were sitting with a smoker in your kitchen for a couple of hours, you might be at the far end of the room 2 meters away at the beginning and you mightn't notice. But within 15 minutes, that could be dangerous for everybody in the room. So when you look at the science of this, what's happening internationally is they're finding that most people who get COVID only pass it on to one other person or maybe nobody, but that a very small number, maybe 20% or 10%, are causing 80% of new cases. So that 10 or 20% that's happening in very particular conditions. It's when there's crowds indoors and there isn't adequate ventilation. Now, in Germany, they have very clearly said there's no point having lockdowns unless we deal with these super spreads. So super spread is where more than five people catch COVID in those kind of indoor unventilated conditions at the same time. And we saw it in the spring in the nursing homes. We saw it in the summer in the meat plants. And we're seeing it again now, possibly even from just people in their own homes, in their own families, or having a few neighbours in. So the way to tackle this, and this is what they're saying internationally, is you have to tell people this. You have to target these particular conditions, and it'll only get worse over the next few weeks in homes, schools, offices, places where people felt they were safe up until now and where they don't realise they're doing something dangerous. And there's also other really interesting research about the kind of climate zone where all the hotspot cities have been. So we all knew it started in Wuhan and then it went to Milan and Madrid and London and Dublin and New York and Seattle. But they all actually happen along a quite a similar latitude where the weather was around 5 to 11 degrees. So that kind of cold weather obviously drives people indoors, but there may also be a climate factor in as well. So if it was like that in the spring, it's back again now in the autumn. And I think we need to deal with that first, rather than shaming people into not visiting elderly people or you know, thinking that they only saw two people last week in the park and now they see one. Reducing those kind of contacts won't make much difference.
I saw, and it was during the week, Joe Duffy was talking about the element of shame and embarrassment in getting the virus. And he was saying people can't be embarrassed or ashamed to get this. It's not your fault if you get it. But we have the opposite message coming from government. It is your fault if you get it, because they're divesting all responsibility for halting the spread. How can we get the government to actually act on the science that's there, stop counter-briefing against science, and then look at these new developments which are coming along? We spoke to Anthony Staines about this yesterday, the day before, and there needs to be a sit down and say, this is the cost of doing it this way, this is the cost of doing it the other way, which one do we pick? And yet we have the Taoiseach has come out and said it needs a short, sharp lockdown. I mean, this is the language you use for guys in hoodies. They need a short, sharp shock. The virus isn't listening to Varadkar. Couldn't give a shit what he thinks. Not a bit. And he's completely off track. Short and sharp doesn't stop this. Long and considered stops this. And that includes proper ventilation. But how do we get it through to them, Orla?
I don't know. I mean, I think obviously politics is very polarised. So people join a camp and they don't move out of it, regardless of what evidence comes out. So we now seem to have two camps. We have the fear camp, which is we need level five immediately, who are not really looking at alternatives because they're terrified. And we have the denial camp, who are saying it's not that bad. Let's get back to normal. And people seem to not be, you know, neither of those groups actually have the solution. And I think those people need to just get out of the way. It needs a multidisciplinary, evidence-based scientific approach. So it needs doctors, it needs virologists, it needs public health specialists, and it needs people who know about environmental engineering, people who know about buildings. I don't see any evidence in the rules that there's people involved who know about buildings. And if the risk is 20% higher indoors, it's critically urgent that we do that. I mean, they've even put out guidance on ventilation that just talks about mechanical ventilation. Now, a tiny percent of our buildings in Ireland are mechanically ventilated. Mostly they're what we call naturally ventilated, which is older buildings were just drafty. They had chimneys and leaky windows and doors, and you know, floorboards, and you got lots of ventilation just by not even opening a window. Newer buildings are much more sealed up. We don't have fireplaces anymore. We have air tightness regulations. So people can be really high risk in newer buildings very, very quickly. So, and particularly as apartments have got smaller and homes have got smaller, the risks have got higher because there just isn't as much air. So, like, I can't understand why people, like, aren't involved with the most basic information about even having your car window open 3 or 4 inches will make it safe if you have a passenger.
Caroline.
I think that's pretty much how I caught COVID, as far as we can tell, was being stuck in a room for 8 hours with another human that's how I gave COVID to someone, so both of us got infected. But we'd no ventilation coming in, and that's a massive concern. But I want to go back to your point about the shame aspect. And, you know, there's a lot of parallels with early HIV infections back in the 80s. And it was like good AIDS, and where you caught it through blood transfusion and through no fault of your own. And then bad AIDS and HIV, that you caught it because you're out partying and, you know, having sex outside marriage and all this thing. And we kind of have that narrative a little bit now where it's like good COVID is like when you caught it and you're caring, when you're a nurse or a doctor or whatever. And bad COVID is like the rest of us, like going out without our masks and going out partying and having our neighbours over, and it's all our fault. And, you know, tough luck to you for getting
Caroline, there's a really good interview on Instagram with Dr. Fauci, with one of his friends and colleagues who he was involved with on the AIDS campaign. And it's a really excellent listen, because he talks about all of that psychology of, you know, how you deal with things and how you bring people with you and what can be really effective risk mitigation. So and he draws parallels with now, and he talks about what needs to be done now. And it's about human behavior. You have to bring people with you on any project. And, you know,
shame,
I think,
doesn't do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can't get a toddler to put on shoes with that approach. You know, you have to bring people with you. And this is a complex project. I think the other element of psychology and all of this is what they found with airline pilots. You know, a lot of crashes happened because people had a plan and they stuck to it. And regardless of changing conditions, they become blind to the conditions they're in, and they lose situational awareness in the panic, and they keep doing the wrong thing, and they don't notice what's happening around them. I think we're stuck with a plan now where maybe there's a resistance to changing context and to loads of new information from the scientific community, which isn't feeding into our policy. So we have a very strong message since March about wash your hands and clean your surfaces. It turns out now that surfaces might be a tiny amount of the spread. It's in the air. And we don't have any public health message that has caught up with the science that matches what they're doing in Germany and Japan, in places that have been much more effective than we are here.
Can I just, sorry, just one thing on that. Going back to what Professor Anthony Stain said, he said that the idea of circuit breaker won't work because you can't just turn off. It's not a light that can be just turned off. You know, that's not what, as you said, that's not what the science says now. He said it's more like a rumor that's got out ahead of you and you're chasing it with the truth, and you're trying to actually, you know, expose it to as much truth as you can. And at the moment, I suppose the argument that he wants, and the likes of Luke O'Neill and several other medics who are involved, and as you said, we need it to be multidisciplinary. We need people from across this to have this debate, to turn around and actually say, if this is where the science is now on this, this is where we go. But I'm just worried that the fact that, you know, 5 days ago the tarnisher went on Claire Byrne, excoriated NPHET and the chief medical officer, and now he's decided that, well, no one will remember that. We'll just talk about a circuit break now. And if we're not, like, I mean, it should be encouraging that your article was in the Irish Times. It was there for people to read. You know, we're getting those opinions out there. But unless it's been across, and too often we're hearing, and this is the biggest problem this week has been, we've been hearing things from economists who are talking in terms of the financial ruination. And we've just seen that there's two things that can't be true. We can't borrow at 0%. Because the markets will give it to us at 0%, and be about to go bust, which is what some of the economists are saying. You can't do those two things at the same time, because they wouldn't lend to you at 0% if they thought you were just about to go bust. No one does. And if we go bust, the whole EU project goes away, because we're all tied into this. So I just don't see where the logic part of people who are supposed to be smart and sensible people and well-trained and well-paid and highly thought of, both politics and economics, they're just not up to the job right now. anyway.
Well, I thought there's two other things, Tony, that can't be true at the same time either. Like, if a level five immediately is going to be effective, why are all the high risk buildings still open and unchanged at level five? So there's no plan. Like, if you look at the list of all the things that are missing, there's no strategy for air purification or spreading people out or managing nursing homes differently. There's no strategy for ventilation at all in the meat, poultry, fish plants, food sector. They'll all stay open. There's no plan for the direct provision centres for overcrowded housing. There's no public information message about ordinary people driving cars and getting on buses and in their kitchens having neighbours in, or even if they're going to party, they should, at least if they knew the rules, they might have a safer party, or they might sit in the garden and put a coat on rather than in the kitchen. But none of the things that are known, identifiable, quantifiable high risks are dealt with in level five. So how do we know level five will work?
The other thing too is there's a big element of magical thinking in this. Politicians our politicians have decided not to act on the best medical advice when it's given. And yet they expect science to solve this somewhere through the middle of next year. So you can't not believe in the science and then hope the science is going to come over the hill and save your arse. And there's no guarantee that that's going to happen either. The short-termism in this is really worrying. You should really plan for this being the situation for the foreseeable. And if things change, change your plan.
Well, I mean, there is a methodology to project management that doesn't seem to be there. There's a methodology to risk assessment. Like, there's a way of doing risk assessment in a very rigorous methodology. I don't see that in the levels. I don't see it in the language that's been used around the levels. So I suspect that those two areas of expertise are not being engaged with, and they could be enormously helpful. Because if you do a risk assessment, you don't wait for proof. You don't wait for proof that it's airborne. There's enough evidence that it's a high risk. So in science, you might wait for proof before you publish it. But in project management, as long as there's a risk, you take it on board and you mitigate it. Now, an announcement today about people opening windows in their cars and in their homes would make a difference this week. And it would be free. Like, that's the easiest risk mitigation ever.
I do remember, it's the one thing I did in college was risk assessment. And it is a pyramid. As soon as you start seeing the small incidents, you know the big incidents is on the way. And that's how it works. Mm. Tony, your mic is gone, buddy.
You're on mute.
No, just we're going to have to move on.
Thanks for having me.
Just Orla, thanks so much for coming on. It's still up on the Irish Times website at the moment, the article. Go check it out. There is one little question, though, in terms of the difference between natural and mechanical ventilation. Are there people is there an argument to say that it might spread rather than mitigate risks, or have we enough data on that yet?
It's too technical into here, Tony. All I can say is, you don't need to be sitting in the freezing cold. Keep a window open. Keep the air moving. Think of it like having a smoker sitting beside you and how you would behave. Sit outside with your coffee with them. Keep the car window open a bit. Keep the kitchen window open. Keep the bedroom window open.
That's why even before lockdown, we sent Martin back to Ashburn because it didn't want anywhere near him. Thanks so much, Orla. I really appreciate you joining us. Caroline, we have to go back to the problems again with sex workers being penalised again. Do you want to just give us an idea of what happened this week?
Yeah, so this is the news that there's a woman in Waterford who had been arrested as a brothel keeper back in 2014. So you can imagine having that hanging over your head for 6 years, which is a bit ridiculous. So she pleaded guilty. She was a migrant worker, and she also pleaded guilty to possession of what's deemed as an unlawful firearm, but was really a canister of pepper spray. Now, we all know, like, the risk of violence and sex work is quite high, so obviously she had that to try and protect herself. The Sex Workers Alliance of Ireland put out a statement to say, you know, again, these laws, we still don't know that if brothel keeping is being reviewed under the current review of the laws. But again, you know, they reminded everyone that the legal situation at the moment under the current 2017 laws is that people can't work together for safety. So it's no real surprise that people would have something like pepper spray to try and protect themselves in the absence of a fully legalized protected system where workers have rights and they have access to safe working conditions. So I think it's really important as well. This is just another highlighting of how the laws in Ireland around sex work could generally prosecute young migrant women who are involved in sex work. And, you know, they're obviously living in fairly precarious situations. A lot of them end up getting deported afterwards or being advised to leave the jurisdiction. And this is after their money gets handed over to certain organizations by the court that will apparently allegedly help them. Air bunny quotes around that. So again, yeah, it's just another like highlight of how like ridiculous the laws are and how they're actually failing people, and prosecuting young migrant women is just not going to be the answer to this.
I think one of the questions that I have about this is, if that was a normal citizen, not a sex worker, and they were found with a can of pepper spray or a can of hairspray that they're going to use to protect themselves, are they going to get targeted? Like, are they going to be found with a weapon the same way as she was, or was it just because she was a sex worker?
Like, unlawful firearm sounds, that I was thinking, is that a machine gun or is some kind of handgun or something like that? So, you know, yeah, like we've all done that walk home at nighttime with our keys in our hands or a deodorant, you know, in our hand and stuff. And it's like we're trying to protect ourselves as much as we can. And when the state deliberately deprives you of a safe working environment because of morality, that's, you know, that's a massive problem.
Look, I'm glad we will continue to bang the drum here across the Tortoise Shack, because it's something that needs to be looked at. We have, you know, all the best human rights lawyers that we speak to warn us against, you know, the models that we've adopted and how we're not actually making conditions safe for people who are in sex work. And we're, and again, back when we go back to human trafficking, how ineffective are human trafficking? We still haven't prosecuted anybody successfully for human trafficking in the history of the state. Crazy stuff like that. I do want to touch on, conscious of how hard this is to say it, but it was the 5-year anniversary of the Carrick Mines fire, and that claimed the lives of 10 members of the travelling community. 10, and there was also one of the women was pregnant, so, you know, it has to be acknowledged as well. And I'm conscious that there's members of the traveller community in the audience as well, so I don't want to speak for anybody, but I will say that it is 5 years on, there has been no improvements in services, there has been no justice. And Linda, sorry, you want to come in?
Yeah, so I know Anne-Marie Quilligan is in the audience, so I wanted to say hi. And I actually have a podcast coming out next week with Anne-Marie where we touch on this. Nothing has improved, nothing. Like, they're still returning housing budgets unused. They're still returning education budgets unused for traveller families. The percentages are much higher for travellers in relation to homelessness, in relation to mental health services, and things like that. And nothing has got better in 5 years since we lost 10 people. And how their families were treated in the aftermath of that was absolutely shocking. And we have members of the Oireachtas now who are still telling people in their local constituencies that they will stop travellers from coming in. It's not acceptable.
Anybody else got any comments on that other than the fact that, like, the amount of times that if this had happened in a working class community or definitely a middle class community, there would have been outrage, uproar, and there would have been inquiry, and there would have been demands for inquiries and all of these things. You know, and I saw Dr. Cindy Joyce tweeting, you know, no justice, no peace. It's almost still an acceptable racism in Ireland.
It is.
Yeah. Like, and there was also an element of blame attached in the coverage to that. It was straight what they went for was blame. Instead of saying, look, these are really bad conditions for people to be living in, it began to focus on, did somebody have a drink? That wouldn't happen if it was a middle class area, Tony. It just simply wouldn't happen.
No, I agree. And
I think that was compounded as well, because the cause of the fire was, you know, meant to be established as being a chip pan being left on. And half us, like, we've all done that, you know, we've just forgotten to switch it off. And I know I have back in the days when I had a chip pan. But it's just that increase, I think, that element of blame and, you know, oh, well, it was their own fault kind of thing. And I suppose, can we just take a moment, just read out the names and establish that these are actually just real humans. They're not just some abstract group. And I don't think, I think the dehumanization of the language we use around travelers and marginalized people can really remove that humanity. So just to name them even, so it's Thomas Connors, Sylvia Connors and their children, Jim, who's 5, Christy, who's 3, and 6-month-old Mary, Willie Lynch, his partner, Tara Gilbert, who's pregnant, and their daughters, Jodie, who's 9, Kelsey, 4, and with Jimmy Lynch as well, who is a brother of Willie. So just to remind the media, I suppose, as well, and everyone else, that these are real humans, no matter your racism, these are actual humans, and we need to remember that. You're going to mute, Tony.
You're mute. Martin too. Definitely there you
Caroline. Go. No, girls are taking over.
Mine actually muted. I think who's playing with it? Obviously, I second everything you said. I saw someone else pointed out in the comments that they're now introducing ways of hiding the disparity of what's been spent in local county councils to hide the accountability of, and they do continue not to spend the budgets. And during the last recession, the global financial crisis, as it was called, the first budget that was absolutely hammered was that for traveller accommodation and traveller education and all of the services that were needed. It is something we're coming back to very shortly. I do want to move on briefly if we can. Brian Wall is there. Brian, yesterday we saw another rally outside the Dáil of members of the National Party, Justin Barrett giving his speech, and we saw people who were counter demonstrators, and today we have to read the imported culture war that is both sides are at it in across the mainstream. And there's certainly not you don't want to see violence on the streets. I thought we settled the argument about the good and bad, good versus bad. There's fascists and then there's anti-fascists. Brian, you covered it a lot yesterday. Do you want to give us a sense of the events?
Essentially it was a rally organized by National Party activists to protest against the lockdown, at least on the surface. There was maybe 100 to 150 tops, I'd say 100 turned up, which good news is their numbers are way down in comparison to the previous few months, and they were met by a lot of barriers that were being placed up and down Kildare Street by the Gardaí, and there was a fairly heavy Garda presence at the public order unit route, and they were also met by around 150 to 200 counter demonstrators, various anti-fascist activists. There was some a bit of scuffling went on towards the start. Basically, they kind of surged, both groups kind of surged towards each other a bit, and the barriers essentially kept them separated, and the guards kind of jumped in and pushed the counter demonstrators way back. And there was some projectiles thrown from the National Party crowd into the counter demonstrators, including at least one firework. And there's been 2 arrests made under the Public Order Act. But the general feeling is that yesterday's rally by the National Party was a complete flop, because the numbers were down and they seemed to be genuinely be scared by the amount of opposition that they met, because they've generally had free rein for the last few months. They've been met by smaller groups of counter protesters, maybe a dozen here and a dozen there, whereas yesterday it was a fairly large showing of opposition to them. And it was interesting because, the Gardaí have come in for a lot of criticism in the last few months over their handling of all these anti-mask and far-right protests. And Justin Barrett, during his very long, very meandering speech, he thanked the guards. He was like, you are of us and we are of you. And, as he's saying that, the public order unit was facing down the counter-protesters. So, it makes for very bad optics, for the Gardaí. And it's, it's just I think verifying for a lot of people that, there's, the Gardaí are policing the left and letting the far right off. It's not a pleasant situation at all. So it remains to be seen, you know, what will happen next. But, you know, it's and like you said, Tony, to start there, you know, we now have, you know, all these articles came out in our wonderful press, you know, both sides to engage in violence. And there's this, I'm not going to say who it was, but there was this ridiculous article in the Irish Examiner. And it's literally one of the, I mean, like, I'm just going to quote from it. The anti-fascists are referred to as Antifa, but it is not clear what exactly they represent.
And can I just put in there, and I just want to say, I kind of get some of the reservations that centrists have around this both sides thing. And I'm putting myself out on a limb here. I kind of get what they're saying. But then I'm reminded of the Battle of Cable Street. And the centrists stood by and were prepared to let the fascists walk through London. And it took the communities to come out and stop them. It wasn't the police. It wasn't the authorities. It wasn't the centrists. So centrists, fine to both sides. But if you're going to sit on your arse and let it happen, you're at fault. You're at fault. You are. Don't blame the people who come out to stop them. Blame yourself for not doing it. That's all I have to say on it. Thanks on that.
Yeah, it's tone policing it. Completely tone policing it. Like, it's, oh, shock and horror. Somebody got their head bashed in a couple of weeks ago and, oh, clutching their pearls over it. It's terrible. It's terrible. But when the people who are on her side come and retaliate, they just don't want to know. Or just keep them off the streets. You know, like, they're just getting platformed left, right and centre. And like, we had a conversation this week about there's a new programme coming to Virgin Media, Eating with Your Enemy. And you know for a fact it's going to have fascists on it. It is absolutely going to have fascists on it. They had Jim Corr, who is like conspiracy theorist, anti-vaccine, everything, in the promo for it. So, you know, when the mainstream media are doing that, you're giving them air, you're giving them oxygen, and you're giving them followers. Stop it.
We've learned. We only have to look across the globe. What is our obsession with wanting to import culture wars, identity politics, all these terms that actually are just lazy terms for mostly greed and bigotry? You know, it's like, let's put a fancy phrase on something to excuse my own ideas that how I want to protect what I have, and I can blame others. And it's quite effective when you look at how it's worked in the US insofar as the Republican Party have managed to use it to manufacture themselves into several presidencies and into holding control of things, because they say it's not our fault, it's the other's fault. And if you guys are over there fighting amongst yourselves, we're still looting the place. And we have this need in Ireland to seem to want to look, if we see it on the Jeremy Kyle show or whatever is the newest thing, let's have some of that. We can have some of that as well. And the idea, yeah, I think it's crazy that Virgin Media are considering this. I think they're still going to proceed with it, because I think these things are considered ratings winners. It's the comment section come to life. I'm not talking about countering free speech. I'm simply talking about, let's not, we know when you platform people and it's not fact-based, that they're going to empower other people who already have those bigotries and that. And we know where that leads. It doesn't lead anywhere good. Just the last thing for in terms of the actual thing, we're going to just go on to our culture section, if you don't mind, because we're pretty much wrapping up. Can I kick off? And I do want to go back to it. It's Isabel Wilkerson's book, Cast, and it's absolutely the most amazing book I've read in the last 10 years. I just keep going back to it. She talks about how the caste system is a class-based system. If you can act your way out of it, it's caste and not race. She breaks down the differences between the race system. Some scary thoughts in it. Like, one, for example, is the idea that only late next year will be the first time America will be as long without slavery as it existed with slavery. So, you know, the idea that these things are, that we all go, it's all in the distant, it's all that so long ago and all nonsense. You know, Alabama got getting rid of one law in 1997, Arkansas 2004. Some of these misogynistic laws where, you know, blacks couldn't marry whites, whites couldn't marry blacks, all of these things still on state statute books up until all in our lifetime. All of this goes to some of the stuff we're talking about with Brian and what we're seeing on the streets. A lot of it stems from this system of greed, and you know, let's tell the truth here: the haves and have-nots. It's class struggle, it's caste struggle, and then the racism, bigotry, and the xenophobia. And I know, which I see Jacob Wolf is in the audience. It always eventually someone goes, oh, and we also have to blame the Jews. Sorry, but that's where this goes. We know the formula. I'd recommend the book. It's just stunning. Caroline.
Mine's a bit less ranty than that. Mine is, of course, themed around sex. And it's a book of poetry called This Is For the Women Who Don't Give a Fuck by Jane Robinson. So Jane with two N's. And I'm not a poetry fan, like Keats or Yeats or whichever one was the painter and not the poet or whatever. That's not my cup of tea at all. But this one's all poems about like sex and dating and abortion and feminism and being just fed up with everything. And it's just really nice, accessible, fun, small poems. So that's my reintroduction to poetry for the 21st century.
I'll go with what I was reading, and I love short classics, really short classics. So Lord of the Flies, I was reading this week again. I just think it's apt for the times we're in. So I just gave it another quick read. I've read Lord of the Flies maybe 20 times, and I've read Animal Farm maybe 100 times. So I think we're in a bit of a Lord of the Flies situation. I'm just waiting for the ship to come in and save us all.
Just waiting on the conch so we can get a word in.
Can I make a shameful admission? I've never read it.
You have to.
Might be my 2020 mission.
Linda.
So mine is actually a tweet. There's a little food magazine. It's a blog called Food Insider. They're at Insider Food. And they did a lovely little 10-minute film about butter that was just so charming and lovely. So if you get a chance, it's from about 3 days ago. So go check it out and just spend 10 minutes of your time falling in love with this lovely Frenchman and his love of butter. It was just unreal.
Look, we're going to leave it there on this section. We will open up the mics now if anybody has any questions or any thoughts, suggestions, and we'll go have a look in the comment section. If you want to participate, come along to these events. Look, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thanks so much, folks.